Hello, and thank you for joining us for another session of Dedication, Fans Remember, the Bay City Rollers, hosted by Bay City Rollers Fan Events. I'm Suze, and with me is Laura. Hey, Laura.
Hi, Suze. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. It's always good to talk to you.
I know. I love you, girl.
Love you, too.
Do we have an exciting two-parter coming up?
I would say so.
We are extremely thrilled to have with us Bob Gruen. Bob is one of the most well-known and respected photographers in rock and roll. From John Lennon to Johnny Rotten, Muddy Waters to the Rolling Stones, Elvis to Madonna, Bob Dylan to Bob Marley, Tina Turner to Debbie Harry, he has captured the music scene for over 40 years in photographs that have gained worldwide recognition. Shortly after John Lennon moved to New York in 71, he became John and Yoko's personal photographer and friend, making photos of their working life as well as private moments. In 74, he created the iconic image of John Lennon wearing the New York City t-shirt that we've all seen, standing in front of the Statue of Liberty, making the peace sign, two of the most popular John Lennon images of all time. He's also worked with major rock acts like Led Zeppelin. He took the famous photo of Led Zeppelin in front of the plane with their name on it. He's worked with The Who, David Bowie. We mentioned Tina Turner earlier, and Elton, Aerosmith, Kiss, Alice Cooper. He toured extensively with the emerging punk and new wave scene, including the New York Dolls, the Sex Pistols, the Clash, the Ramones, Patti Smith, Blondie. We're dropping some names here, and it's okay. his Sid Vicious with the hot dog photo was acquired in 1999 by the National Portrait Gallery in London for their permanent collection. And I believe David Bowie was one of the curators for that, and he selected that picture. Of all the photos that he took, they wanted the picture of Sid Vicious housing a hot dog. In June of 2004, he was presented with Mojo Magazine's prestigious Honors List Award for Classic Image in London, and in 2010, he was inducted into the Long Island Music Hall of Fame. Whew! And that's not even covering anything, but that's a whopper of an intro, don't you think?
That's a pretty amazing introduction.
Yeah,
wow.
And on a personal note, he's been, if you know me for 5 minutes, you know I'm a Bob Gruen fan, and he's like kind of been an inspiration for me and for years, since I was 12 or 13. So this is quite an exciting podcast for us.
So I can't wait.
Yeah, without further ado, should we get right to it?
Yes, we should.
Okay, Laura, thank you for everything, as always. Here we go.
You're welcome.
Hello, Bob. Thank you so much for talking with us today. You doing all right?
Yep.
Good.
Glad to be here.
Oh, thank you. Well, first of all, congratulations on the release of your book, Right Place, Right Time. There are several books out featuring your well-known, well, iconic, really, photographs, including my favorite, your coffee table book, Rock Scene. I love it. It's on my table all the time. People love looking at it when they come over. But Right Place, Right Time is actually your autobiography.
Right.
I really enjoyed reading it. I read it in about a day. I just like consumed it. I did. I mean, I'm actually a pretty big fan of yours, and I'm going to try to keep my fangirl down, but you know who we are, so it's okay for me to be a fangirl. You know us. You know us.
I remember.
You remember us. I wasn't yes. A screamer. I was kind of quiet, but you know our passion.
Yeah.
I found that the writing style really like replicated the excitement that was happening. I mean, one minute here, the next minute there, you know, no matter what chapter you were on, you really didn't know what was going to happen in that chapter. Like, you didn't know from one minute to the next where you were going to be. It was all very, it was very, very exciting. I just, like I said, I devoured it.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. You photographed and you toured with just about every legend and captured probably every pivotal moment in New York City's music history. And of course, your reputation definitely precedes you. But for the purpose of our podcast, the Bay City Roller Fans, I'm going to concentrate on chapter 19, Money Honey, and your time photographing and touring with the Bay City Rollers. Are you ready to go back in time with me?
Sure.
Good. So do you remember the first time you met the...
Do you have a little of that dreamy music to fade?
Oh, yeah, I should play a little something. Summer love sensation or something. Do you remember the first time you met them and your first session with them?
I'm not sure. I'd have to look, actually. You know what? I might have the file right here. I could look. I remember Carol Strauss. Where's the Basie Rollers now? Down there. I'm talking to my wife here. We're trying to pull out the file. All right, well, until we find it.
Yeah,
I remember Carol calling me up, and I'd worked with Carol. She was a publicist for the Rolling Stones, for the Who, a number of other groups. So I had done quite a bit of work with her, before the Rollers came. And so at first, it just seemed like another band. She said they're very popular. They all say that. I didn't realize how popular.
Yeah.
Were and how fanatic their fans were. Just see here, Bay City. I think the first Bay City one was. This is when we went to Rockefeller Center. They did a press, tour around New York, and it was quite a day. Let me see. Let me just check this one here. Sorry, taking the time here. Yeah,
that's okay.
Yeah, we did several places around New York. I remember we went to Rockefeller Center. We took some pictures at this above the skating rink there,
mm-hmm.
and then went up on top of the top of the rock. There used to be there is now an observation platform up there, and. I guess it was around 76 or so.
Yeah.
Is that when they came? Yeah. And we went up to the observation platform. It was the first time I had been there with a band, and it was a great spot because, a lot of people think if you come to New York City, you go up on top of the Empire State Building.
Right.
Building here.
Better views
but then
at the Rock.
The Empire State is not in the picture.
Yeah, the better views the
and,
Rock.
But if you go to the Rock, it's a much better view because you see the Empire State Building straight on. And down in the distance was the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And it just says New York City.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
And in fact, after the Rollers, that's where I learned it. I went back a couple years later, did a self-portrait when I was in a magazine. I brought the Clash there in 81, I think. That's a famous picture. And then 30 years later, I came back with,
Green Day. Green Day.
With Green Day.
I'll help you out, Bob. Don't worry. I know everything.
And the thing was that I knew about Green Day was in the building because that's where they tape a lot of TV shows.
Yeah, Saturday Night Live. Yeah.
The Clash were in there doing the Tom Snyder show.
Oh, wow.
And then when the Green Day was on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
I did a lot of work with Green Day, so I was talking to him, and I said, you're in the same building I took the picture of the Clash, and can we go up on the roof? And then Saturday Night Live, those people were very nervous because they're live, and they start on Tuesday, and again by Saturday, you have to be there, like, in the morning.
Right.
And 12 hours before the show, because they're so nervous that somebody might not show up, and then they don't let you out all day. And I said, well, we're not going out, we're just going to go up to the roof, see if we get permission. And it was a big deal to get permission to go up there.
Is that right?
And when I went up there, and the head of security came along with us, the head of the whole Rockefeller Center security came up with us. And when we came down, he said, I have your Clash picture on my wall for the last 20 years.
Wow.
So it's really a great spot, and I got to thank the Bay City Rollers.
Yeah. I actually think it was 75 because we celebrated the 40th anniversary in 2015. So that's okay. We were close. At the time that you came around with them, you've already photographed, people like Lennon, Alice Cooper. What did you make of these guys? I mean, what was your first impression and their image? It was definitely different than Alice Cooper.
Well, yeah. But
I also different.
Worked with Tina Turner. I worked with Debbie Harry. By then, I think I was just meeting Debbie Harry around that time. I found them to be really nice people, people you could really get along with, telling jokes, being pretty polite. They were not drinkers. In fact, there was no alcohol or drugs around them at all. Mm. I think I once had a sip of some cognac or something, and Tam smelled it across the room. He's like, "Who's got alcohol?"
Is that right?
I was asking him one day, and I was like, "Oh, sorry. You know, I had a sip out in the bar in the audience." And he could tell right away. It was very, very, straight up, but not straight in a boring way. They were always fun.
Well, it was still exotic to meet people from another country, wasn't it? Then, you know, flight travel was taking off. You know, literally, it was. You know, it was not a novelty to hear those accents and see those costumes they were in. That's why we loved it.
Well, their outfits were very different. Mm. And the fact that they had a look. And a look that was very different. That was Scottish.
Yeah.
You know, nobody ever heard of trying to look Scottish.
Exactly.
You know, wearing plaid. And this was actually before, you know, the punk rockers kind of picked up a bit on the plaid, but this was before that. And I found it actually interesting a couple of years later when Sex Pistols toured in 78, Punk Magazine had an issue that had that featured the Sex Pistols and the Bay City Rollers.
Wow, is that right? Talk about a clash.
I always thought they were kind of very different.
Yeah.
Very different. But the fact that the music was so lively, it was so much fun, and Punk Magazine was actually about having fun.
Yeah.
And the fact that they, you know, that they recognized how much fun the Bay City Rollers were. And I think that was my main impression, is when they played their shows, they were always upbeat, everybody was smiling, the songs are basically sing-along, you know, follow the bouncing ball, mm-hmm. and sing-along, they're so easy.
Right.
And yet they're very meaningful.
Absolutely.
You know, and so it was just easy to get into them and easy to have fun with them. And the kids were so passionate, the audience. But I found it, for me, it was a lot easier because when you have a very passionate bunch of fans, and for The Who, for instance, they're all like over 200 pounds and drunk.
Yeah, you're going to get trampled.
And when you have a bunch of 250, 300 pound drunk people running to the stage, that's dangerous. But when you have like 90 pound, 13, 14 year old girls who are just as excited, but not nearly as dangerous.
Yeah,
Maybe even more excited. Because I don't think the Who fans passed out from hyperventilation.
No, Roller fans definitely
did. But the
did.
BC Roller fans, they definitely passed out. I have a picture of, I think it was Philadelphia, there must be 50 kids in the passing out. Because when they would pass out, they would carry the kids out to a recovery room.
Yeah.
And basically, it was hyperventilating because they were yelling so much that you're just screaming and breathing so fast that you over-oxygenate your blood.
Yeah.
You just have too much oxygen and you pass out. And the way to cure that is basically to breathe into a bag. And just breathe your own carbon dioxide back in and bring your oxygen level down. So you see this whole room of kids breathing in these paper bags, and they were prepared. Like they had security ready with bags for the kids to breathe into.
Yeah.
And that's the only time I ever saw that. They didn't do that with other bands. They didn't need to. But I never saw the Beatles either. So
They should have given you a bag with your ticket.
Yeah,
I was at that Philadelphia. Philadelphia show at the Tower Theater, so I know exactly the room that you're talking about.
I do. It was quite, and I do want to mention, because it's something I bring up when I do interviews. The Bay City Rollers are the only other band besides the Beatles that had a mania.
Mm-hmm.
There's other fans like Bieberism or whatever they call the fans of some of the bands today. But only Beatlemania and Rollermania were actually manias.
That's something, isn't it?
And they were very similar in the sense of hundreds of girls screaming, running down the street after the bus or around the hotel. When we were in Tokyo, there were 3,000 kids around the hotel all day, all night.
Wow.
It might have gone down to only 2,000 at night. But it was chaos. Every time we came in and out of the hotel, there was always screaming kids. And it was after the Rollers, actually, the Hilton banned rock and roll bands for a number of years after that, because it was just such chaos. It was hard to do anything else in the hotel because all these kids were just all over the front. I remember one girl actually got her hand caught in a revolving door. Luckily, it was, you know, it was soft rubber. It didn't break her hand, but there was a lot of screaming going on when that happened.
That's a massive amount of people. I mean, we definitely didn't rival that, you know, city for city, you know? That's a lot of people. Right. Wow, that must have been something to see. Yeah. Well, you did...
And there was one kid, I don't remember what his name was, but there was one young guy, actually, who followed the band around the country. He was in Philadelphia, he was in Chicago, or wherever we were. He would show up, outside the hotel. And then in Los Angeles, they found out he was actually sleeping in, like, the parking lot of the hotel. And by that time, he'd been to so many shows, I think Sam bought him a room.
Was he from New York?
I'm not sure. Yeah. He kind of looked like a character on a TV show called Horseshack.
Yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about. His nephew.
You know
his name
what I mean?
Is. Yeah.
We used to call him that. And later, I always felt like, why do we make fun of that kid? He was such a passionate young guy. Having fun.
Yeah, he I think his name was Jeff, and I think he's out in Vegas. And
I think that sounds familiar.
Yeah, I think because he was in all the pictures in 16 magazine, because a guy in roller gear was like, wow, what is that,
you know? It was so unusual.
So you definitely remembered him. Yeah,
and one of the most passionate, because he traveled, he showed up everywhere.
God bless him. I wish I knew how close Philadelphia was to New York. To me, it was a world away, you know. It's a 90-minute train ride, but when you're 12 years old,
right,
you don't think, hey, I'm going to take a ride.
You don't get an interstate train ride by yourself when you're 12.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Well, did you see the party there, by the way, when they were in New York? It was interesting that day that the day they were coming to New York, the night before, John Lennon had called me early in the morning. It was the time that they were meeting with all the lawyers, and they were finally settling their contract with Alan Klein, their manager. They had been trying to break up the contract for several years, and it was the big moment. And John called me to come and take pictures of them signing the new contract, the agreement to dissolve the old contract. And then I gave him a ride home afterwards, it was 9 in the morning or something, because I often would drive them around after recording sessions or something like that. So I was giving them a ride home, and I said, oh, by the way, you know, the Bay City Rollers are in town tonight, and of course, like everybody, they're huge fans, they would love to meet you. And John said, well, tell them that there's still a band in 5 years, I'll meet them then.
Oh.
And which didn't happen.
Yeah.
And then I said to him, well, is there any advice you can give them? And he said, well, tell them to get all their money now in their own name.
Oh, if only they listened.
And I told him that. If only they had listened, they would have saved themselves a lot of trouble. But I think John knew that, because that particular day he was trying to get all of his money back into his name.
Sure.
So that's why it was kind of on his mind.
Yeah, it sadly wasn't an unusual story back then, was it?
No, not at all.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Normal.
Well, I mean, as roller fans, we know that you photographed all those early shots during their first visit to New York, all the bubblegum cards, they're all your pictures. As you were, you know, as you were taking them around to all these, you know, major New York stops, I guess it was Coney Island where you did the Nathan's Hot Dogs.
We went all around. It wasn't my choice. I mean, I just got in the car with me.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if it was Carol or Tam or, you know, whoever it was that made those decisions.
You didn't do the scouts?
Where we went.
You didn't scout the locations for that?
No.
Well, what was
like I say, they took me to the top of the rock. That was the first time I was there.
Oh, God. That's okay, got it. So when you were out there on the street with them, what was the reaction on the streets? I mean, I know in New York, you know, anything's possible to see, but, you know.
You don't get a lot of reaction in New York.
Yeah, it's true.
You got to be more than weird to get attention in New York.
Yeah, I guess if you were in Peoria.
I've heard of a band called Lordi from Finland that are dressed as, like, horrible monsters. I mean, they make Kiss look conservative.
Wow.
I had them in Times Square, and nobody gave us a sideways glance.
Yeah.
You really have to be more than weird. So to have five guys walking around in plaid, no big deal.
That was no big deal. That was tame.
Another band, another group. I mean, there's lots of that in New York, you know, groups of people doing things. So I don't think they really got that kind of reaction, unless somebody recognized them. If it was a fan, they got a reaction.
Yeah, and what did you think of the fan reactions overall?
I thought it was fun.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it was fun. I you know, it was exciting. They weren't bothering me. I was trying to pull my clothes off. So it was really kind of fun to see people that excited and having that much fun. You know, it was a nice feeling.
It really was a good teenage experience, personally speaking. I mean, we had a lot of fun experiences. Our world was open. You know, we became Anglophiles and wanted to read everything that was going on in the London music scene. So it really opened up a lot, you know, just because it was opening up the world in a way that, you know, we didn't. Just trying to understand their accents was like a study.
Yeah, just trying to figure out what they were saying.
Right.
Although I remember I didn't really have trouble understanding them so much. I mean, some of my English friends, I have to keep saying what, because you can't understand them at all, some of those accents. But I remember the roles were pretty easy to understand and talk to. I particularly got along with Les, you know, Q, and he was... He kind of reached out more. He was more interested in what was going on around New York, asking questions about the other bands, about Max's Kansas City.
Mm.
Whereas the other guys were just pretty complacent in a sense. I mean, they were working hard. They were, you know, they didn't want to do anything else. But Les seemed to be more curious, you know, about what was around him, what was going on in places we were in.
Well, that kind of leads me into my next question. I was going to ask you what, you know, what your impression or thought was on each member. So, okay, and also their management, Tam.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that kind of answered that,
unless
you wanted to.
I mean, Les was the one, like I said, I talked to most. Like, we just kind of fell into a very easy communication and conversations. Woody, I remember, is kind of a Charlie Chaplin-esque kind of character, you know, he's kind of just making funny faces.
Yeah, kind of hamming, goofy, but
hamming
cute.
It up, yeah.
Goofy, but cute.
But very cute. Yeah. I mean, all of them, the other, the other guys were just kind of conservative, doing their job. I didn't really get to, you know, too involved with them talking and so on. Les was the one who, you know, always drew me out into conversations. Tam seemed a bit odd.
Yeah.
On some levels. On the other, he seemed quite, you know, world-aware manager. You know, he knew that he was dealing with something very big.
He was savvy, yeah. He was definitely savvy.
I remember him meeting, now I'm going blank on his name. Like a really big entertainment lawyer, you know, having a conversation, about bands and what was going on, and Tam seemed quite on top of the business end of things. But surprisingly, you know, there wasn't a lot of merchandise for bands even back then. You know, as much as there had been for the Beatles, you know, all kind of Beatles things, there wasn't a lot of roller things. And I found very interesting that you couldn't buy a roller costume.
You could in the UK. But
they didn't have it here.
No, we had to make our own.
Which I thought was fantastic. That everybody made their own clothes. It wasn't a merchandise thing, which was too bad for the band.
Right.
Not that they would get any of it, but you know, but the fact that they had all these different outfits and everybody's was unique. And that's why I found it really cute. Like, we go to the theater for the sound check in the afternoon, and the fans are already lined up outside, you know, 4 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, waiting for a 7 o'clock show. Almost the whole theaters were full of, you know, was out on the sidewalk.
Right.
But they weren't just standing there like a lot of other, you know, band fans just stand there and talk to whoever they came with. The roller fans were all talking to each other. They brought their scrapbooks, and they were showing each other the scrapbooks with all the, you know, pictures from all different magazines, and they were showing off their clothes.
Yeah.
Because they were all unique, they were all different, and nobody had bought them in a store, nobody had bought them at the souvenir counter after the concert. They all had to make them, and I found that absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, like I said, it really was to be young and have that as a hobby or whatnot, and we did. We made our own stuff. We were resilient, we were, you know, just clever, I think, you know, and it is a community. Yeah. I mean, even now.
Well, especially when you have kids that young.
Yeah.
Making their own clothes.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, that maybe not, you know, the whole clothes, but they're decorating them and, you know, adding all the plaid and, you know, adding accessories and so on.
Yeah.
I found that fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, even the buttons we wore, we made our buttons. We had, you know, decoupage. We were going for it. It was a lot of fun.
I'm into fashion myself. And I remember when I went to one of the first Rolling Stones concerts I ever went to, and I put some ribbons on, you know, kind of those ribbons that they make for guitar straps.
Right.
It's like 2-inch wide woven thing. I sewed them on my pants to rock and roll.
Very cool.
And I've always kind of tried to fit in, you know, with the bands that I'm with. Like, if I was with Kiss, I'd wear a leather jacket. With the Bass Eagles, I had several shirts. A girl I knew actually printed up T-shirts, made me one that said "Money, Honey." I think I had, and I think one of them was "Saturday Night" or something clever. But then I found one that friends of mine made a sweater. And I generally wear blue, and it was a pretty much of a blue sweater. But across the middle were three frames of film, you know, like a with sprocket marks,
right.
Sprocket holes. So
yeah.
You know, it was these three squares, but with sprocket holes. So it looked like obviously like three frames of film. And the middle frame, I mean, all the frames had plaid. It was just a plaid
perfect
design in the picture. And I thought, well, that's, you know, the pictures are plaid. That's me. That's what I'm doing.
That's amazing.
And so that became my roller uniform. Yeah. Was this sweater that had the plaid on it, which is the only time actually I've ever worn plaid. It's not my, not really something I'm into.
Well, and you did travel extensively with them photographing. I mean, you mentioned Japan.
We were in Los Angeles. We were in Los Angeles and in Miami, and then I got a call when they were going to Japan. I got a call from a Japanese magazine who asked me, because they'd seen that I had some pictures of the rollers, and asked me if I could have access to the rollers in Japan. If I did, they would pay for my flight to Japan to be with the rollers. So I called Tam and I said, you know, can I have, you know, same kind of access? Because I was basically with the band. I was
yeah.
in the limo. I was, you know, in the dressing room. There was no place I couldn't go when I was with the rollers. You know, one of the all access, you're okay, you can come in kind of pass, you know. And I called Tam. He said, yeah, we'd love to have you in Japan. So I flew over and met him there. And that was a great time. That's when we were in the Hilton and all the fans were outside.
Do you remember what the lineup was then? Was that when Pat was in the band? When you went to Japan?
I think Pat was in the band when we were in Japan. Because
yeah.
I remember Tam took me down to the gym, like a spa downstairs,
mm-hmm.
and had me doing some kind of beefcake pictures, you know.
Yeah.
Them, you know, in like their underwear sitting on a yeah. massage table or yeah. in the hot tub or yeah. something like that. But
what do you think?
I'm pretty sure Ian was one of them.
What do you think of those pictures today, looking at them? I'm like a little, I don't know. Back then, I was probably like, oh, this is great. Yeah, but, you know.
I was just doing what I was told. Hey. Sam was, you know, directing, and I was taking a picture, and I thought, this is a little funny, but I guess, you know, the kids like it.
Yeah.
You know, they were so passionate, and nothing, I mean, I see nothing wrong with being sexy. You know?
No, of course not.
So
we just didn't know what that meant yet. We didn't know what that meant yet. But
right.
we were learning.
Well, so I thought it was also innocent. And
yeah, it was.
Like, you know, but and it wasn't, they weren't posing provocatively. They were, you know, just kind of posing pretty normally.
Yeah, I mean, they're casually. Really, they're actually pretty benign shots, if, I mean, by today's standards.
But on the other hand, I mean, I know that Les was very good at winding the audience up and getting them, you know, to come down front, and he would hold his hand out, and he would touch the kids, and you know, and that was, what show was it? There was one place that was so strict, I think Buffalo or someplace, where they wanted everybody to stay in their seats.
Ha, fat chance.
And it wasn't going to happen.
No
and,
way.
You know, and Les came out, I mean, the band came out and started playing, these kids are like so tense, you know, kind of bouncing up and down in their seats, and the guards looking around, you know, anytime anybody got actually up, the guard would yell. And Les saw the guard trying to control the crowd, and he leaned down, held his hand out, and the girl came up and touched his hand, and he kissed her.
Oh.
And that did it. The whole room fell apart. The guard totally lost control. Everybody ran down to the front of the stage. It was so well done. He did it so casually.
Oh.
But, whoa, what a moment.
Yeah.
Everybody in the room wanted to be there.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
that was
pretty funny. I was at a Tower Theater show, and I had row like Zed all the way in the back. I'm like, how is Woody gonna see me back here? How's he gonna
right.
find? And it was just, you know, very stressful. I was going to get up there, but I never did. It was a long way up to the double A's in the front.
Well, it was fun for me because I never saw the Beatles. I mean, for all my work with John Lennon, and I actually met and photographed all the other three Beatles over the 70s, but I never saw them in the 60s as Beatles.
Right, during that pandemonium.
Except on TV, you know. So to be with the Rollers was really exciting, and it was very similar, like I say, you know, as far as the passion and the, you know, intense, chaos of the fans, just, you know, screaming and running and, you know, literally to the point of passing out.
Yeah.
Since I wasn't passing out, it was fun for me.
Yeah, to watch it.
You know, was that I made more money off the Bay City Rollers than any other band.
I was going to ask, that was my next question. We're going to close this session here for this week. Exciting stuff, isn't it? What a thrill. Please join us next week for part 2, where Bob gets into chapter 19, called Money Honey, from his autobiography, Right Place, Right Time. Thanks for listening and for your amazing support. And as always, keep on rolling.